Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 13, which I will entitle Judgment on Babylon. We start now in verses 1 through 3 of Isaiah 13. We read this, an oracle concerning Babylon that Isaiah son of Amoz saw. Raise a banner on a bare hilltop. Shout to them. Beckon to them to enter the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my holy ones. I have summoned my warriors to carry out my wrath. Those who rejoice in my triumph. Now, according to one of my commentators, this prophecy was probably given during the reign of Ahaz, who ruled from 732 to 716 BC. Babylon fell to the Persians in 539 BC, so we're talking about just under 200 years between the time that the prophecy was given and the time that the prophecy was fulfilled. Isaiah says, raise a banner on a bare hilltop. That would refer to the mustering together or the gathering together of soldiers as they go to the flag of their unit, as the soldiers are getting ready to attack. And of course, that would be Persian soldiers getting ready to attack Babylon. Isaiah continues in verse 2, beckon to these soldiers to enter the gates of the nobles. Now, the easiest way to interpret that is that the Persians are going to enter into the gates of the Babylonian nobles. But it could be that it refers to Persian soldiers coming to the doors of the leaders or generals of the army to give their names to enlist themselves in the service of the nobles or the generals. I think it's easier just to say that Isaiah is beckoning the Persian soldiers to come on into Babylon for rich plunder. Verse 3, Isaiah says, I have commanded my holy ones, my set-apart ones, my dedicated ones, my consecrated ones, and here he's not referring to his saints. He's referring to the Persian army. The army of the Medes and the Persians. They were set apart, and that's what holy means, but they were set apart for a special work, namely destroying Babylon. That does not mean they were set apart to God like God's beloved children. And at the end of verse 3, Isaiah says, I have summoned my warriors to carry out my wrath. He's using the words of God here. I, God, have summoned my warriors to carry out my wrath. So the warriors, of course, were Cyrus and the officers of the Persian armies, the common soldiers, they are said to belong to God, my warriors, to carry out my wrath. So Babylon was going to destroy Israel, and God's going to destroy Babylon. Now these warriors that are going to carry out God's wrath are said at the end of verse 3 to rejoice in God's triumph. They rejoiced, okay, but they didn't rejoice with the same motives as God. They rejoiced in being able to beat the Babylonians. The Persians rejoiced. But they didn't rejoice because they were doing God's will. They were using their free will to inadvertently and unknowingly to carry out God's will. But they rejoiced because they beat the Babylonians. We go now to Isaiah 13, verses 4 through 9. Isaiah continues, listen, a noise on the mountains like that of a great multitude. Listen, an uproar among the kingdoms like nations massing together. The Lord Almighty is mustering an army for war. They come from faraway lands, from the ends of the heavens, the Lord and the weapons of his wrath, to destroy the whole country. Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. Because of this, all hands will go limp. Every man's heart will melt. Terror will seize them. Pain and anguish will grip them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at each other, their faces aflame. See, the day of the Lord is coming, a cruel day with wrath and fierce anger, to make the land desolate and destroy the sinners within it. This is why people use the adjective biblical to describe a biblical catastrophe, because these catastrophes were described with such florid precision by the Old Testament prophets. First of all, verse 4, a noise on the mountains. That could be the mountains of Persia or Media, to the north of Persia, where the soldiers flocked in vast numbers to the standard that was set on the hills, or it could refer to the mountains upon the borders of Babylon. Remember, Babylon is in the Mesopotamian Valley on the Euphrates River. Medo-Persia was to the west of Babylon, to the west of the Mesopotamian Valley, to the west of the Zagros Mountains, to the west of the Tigris Rivers in present-day Iran, Media being to the north and the rest of Persia to the south. So this noise on the mountains here could be the army of Cyrus marching out of Iran into Mesopotamia, marching toward Babylon. I think that's what it is. Listen, an uproar among the kingdoms, like nations massing together. Cyrus's army consisted of several kingdoms and nations. There was Media in today's northern Iran, but also the kingdoms of Ararat, Mene, and Ashkenaz, as we learn from Jeremiah 51, verses 27 and 28. Raise a signal flag in the land. Blow a ram's horn among the nations, says Jeremiah. Set apart the nations against her. Now, Jeremiah is prophesying against Babylon, so he's talking about raise the flag and set apart the nations against Babylon. Summon kingdoms against her, Ararat, Mene, and Ashkenaz. Appoint a marshal against her. Bring up horses like a swarm of locusts. Set apart the nations for battle against her, the kings of Media, her governors and all her officials and all the lands they rule. Remember, Media is allied closely as part of the Persian kingdom, the Medo-Persian kingdom. Now, these other places, Ararat, that's the famous place where Noah's Ark landed. It's a mountain or a mountain range in eastern Turkey near the border of Iran and Armenia. As you head up there in the area, roughly between the Caspian and the Black Seas, Mene, which is also named Menea in Wikipedia, that's in, again, also in northwestern Iran, south of Lake Urmia in that same area. And Ashkenaz, according to the Jewish journal The Ford, is probably the steppe lands north of the Black Sea. So that's also in the rough general area. The Greeks used to call these people the Scythians. So basically, it's all the nations of the Iranian plateau there, in present-day Iran, all the nations there, what we normally would lump together as Persia, they're coming after Babylon. And so we see this phrase kingdoms in Isaiah 13, verse 4, listen and uproar among the kingdoms, is referring to all these kingdoms or nations which are massing together against the Babylonians. In verse 5, the armies of these kingdoms come from faraway lands. Of course, Iran is a long way from Israel, from the ends of the heavens. Same idea, long way away, because heavens don't really have an end. The end of the sky, if you will, as you look at the horizon. The Lord and the weapons of his wrath. Of course, the weapons of God's wrath are the Persians, the Medes and the Persians, the Medo-Persians, to destroy the whole country. That's destroy the whole country of Babylon, and that word is Eretz, which can be translated land. The Holman Christian Study Bible has or earth instead of country or earth. Young's Little Translation has land. So we don't want to say that God is going to destroy the whole earth. That would be a misstatement. This is a prophecy on Babylon, not the whole earth. Verse 6, Isaiah says, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. Ah, there's that phrase, day of the Lord, which most people assume is the end of the world. It is not necessarily referring to the end of the world, because here it's obviously referring to the end of Babylon. The day of the Lord is a general term for a day of judgment, not necessarily the end of the world. And here it obviously refers to judgment on Babylon. I bring this up and emphasize it because there are so many people who want to take prophecies and refer them to the end of the world. Futurists are very prone to this. Now, this day of the Lord coming upon Babylon will cause all hands to go limp. All men's hearts will melt. Terror will seize everybody. Pain and anguish will grip them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. Obviously, the Israelites had not heard of the Lamaze method, which will keep a woman from writhing in pain when she's in labor. But we get the point here. Everybody in Babylon will look aghast at each other. Their faces aflame. Now, what does aflame mean? Their faces could be red with blushing through shame, or their faces could be pale with fear as the color of flame. I don't know. Red aflame doesn't sound pale to me. Another option is that their faces could look like the faces of blacksmiths who work at a forge, making weapons to desperately defend themselves. To no avail. That's sort of a stretch. One of my commentators says that aflame here, and the words around it may be rendered, their faces are as the faces of Lahabim. The Lahabim are the name of a people mentioned in Genesis 10:13, and they are the same with the Libyans, and the Libyans had faces of a blackish or tawny color, kind of like Egyptians, I guess. So it could be said that their faces were black with anguish. Well, again, why does a face get dark or tawny? because it's anguished. I don't know. I think that's a stretch too. I think you could just take it this way. Their faces were aflame with terror. We know what that means. We don't have to worry about what particular color the face is. Verse 9, see, the day of the Lord is coming, that same day of judgment on Babylon, a cruel day with wrath and fierce anger to make the land desolate and destroy the sinners within it. Bye-bye, Babylon. We go now to Isaiah 13, verses 10 through 13. The stars of heaven and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their sins. I will put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and will humble the pride of the ruthless. I will make man scarcer than pure gold, more rare than the gold of Ophir. Therefore I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will shake from its place at the wrath of the Lord Almighty in the day of his burning anger. Now this is typical decreation rhetoric that Old Testament prophets used when they wanted to indicate regime change, and the Babylons were about to experience regime change. They were going to get wiped out. Now, this is my favorite place to go, Isaiah 13, when people want to take Jesus' words in the Olivet Discourse about the sun going dark and the moon turning red. Oh, that's the end of the world. It's the Great Tribulation, the seven-year period before Jesus comes back. And they want to take it literally. And I say, well, this is the same language that's used in Isaiah 13, 10 through 13, and that's not taken literally. Well, let's see if we can make an argument that dispensationalists would be happy with to say that this passage is literal. Of course, dispensationalists love literalism. Well, could it be an eclipse to make the sun dark and the moon not give its light? No, it cannot be, because there are no astronomical records of such an eclipse taking place in 539 BC. You could say it's clouds. The moon won't give its light because of clouds. The sun will not give its light because it's dark. The problem with that is, so what? I mean, the sun goes dark and the moon goes dark that way around my house all the time, but that's not an indication of regime change or destruction or judgment. Well, here is another option to perhaps argue that this decreation rhetoric should be taken literally. One could say that the sun is darkened and the moon is darkened because of smoke from the burning city of Babylon. The problem with that is there is absolutely no historical evidence that Babylon was burned in 539 BC. You can posit it, suggest it, but you can't prove it that Babylon was burned. So those are some very weak options. It makes more sense to take this decreation rhetoric as figurative, not literal. Here's what Adam Clark says. The Hebrew poets, to express happiness, prosperity, the instauration and advancement of states, kingdoms, and potentates. Instauration is just a fancy word for inauguration or establishment of. The instauration and advancement of states, kingdoms, and potentates. The Hebrew poets make use of images taken from the most striking parts of nature, from the heavenly bodies, from the sun, moon, and stars, which they describe as shining with increased splendor and never setting. The moon becomes like the meridian sun, and the sun's light is augmented sevenfold. New heavens and a new earth are created, and a brighter age commences. On the contrary, the overflow and destruction of kingdoms is represented by opposite images. The stars are obscured, the moon withdraws her light, and the sun shines no more. The earth quakes, and the heavens tremble, and all things seem tending to their original chaos. Well, this is a problem for dispensationalists. Here's what their problem is. If they say this language is figurative, then one might reasonably ask, well, why isn't the same language of Jesus in the Olivet Discourse figurative? Matthew 24:29, Jesus says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not shed its light. The stars will fall from the sky. The celestial powers will be shaken. And, of course, I'm sure you've read all the Left Behind and the Hal Lindsey books about how this is going to literally happen. But if the language is figurative in Isaiah 13, why isn't the same language figurative in Matthew 24:29 when Jesus is talking? In fact, Jesus is probably quoting Isaiah. And also, if the dispensationalist says that the language in Isaiah 13 is figurative, which it most apparently is, well, then they have a problem, because then what has happened to dispensationalism's vaunted literalism? We've got to take the scripture literally, they say over and over and over again, ad nauseum. But yet here in Isaiah 13, well, it's not really literal here. Well, maybe they could say that Isaiah 13 is literal. Well, then, when did it happen? I just showed you there's no evidence that any of it happened. There's no astronomical evidence of any kind of eclipse to darken the sun. There's no evidence of any city of Babylon burning to darken the face of the sun. Well, here is how Guzik, a dispensationalist commentator, takes it. In the near fulfillment of the judgment of Babylon, they felt like the whole world was coming apart. In the ultimate fulfillment connected with the return of Jesus, the whole world will be falling apart. Well, now, folks, I don't want to be obnoxious or anything, but that's just plain pathetic. In other words, a dispensationalist who's a literalist is going to say that Isaiah 13 is figurative because the people just felt like the world was falling apart, but it wasn't actually falling apart. But then when Jesus starts talking about it in the Olivet Discourse, oh, yes, it will fall apart literally. Please, I'm not that dumb. I've got to be careful here. I don't want to offend anybody. In verse 11, Isaiah speaking for God, or God speaking through Isaiah, God says, I will punish the world for its evil. Now, this is not talking about the whole world here. It's talking about the kingdom of Babylon. Well, why did Isaiah say it was the world? Isaiah called Babylon the whole world because of the Babylonian Empire's large extent and the number of its inhabitants. Just like the Roman Empire is called the whole world in Luke chapter 2, verse 1 in the King James. This is a familiar verse from Christmas time. And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And of course, that's referring to the Roman Empire, not the whole planet. Now, Guzik, the dispensationalist, says here that it is the whole world. He says, quote, we aren't surprised that Isaiah has prophetically combined the vision of Babylon's judgment with the judgment of the whole world for its evil. Well, no, that is not what Isaiah is talking about here. He's talking about God punishing Babylon. God says in verse 11, I will put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and will humble the pride of the ruthless. Verse 12, I will make man scarcer than pure gold. What does he mean by that? Well, the easiest way to interpret that is to say that the men in Babylon will become so scarce because they're defeated in battle and they're slaughtered. And so there's not very many men in Babylon. Pure gold, of course, is very rare. More rare than the gold of Ophir. Ophir is someplace down in the Arabian Peninsula. Maybe where Yemen is, nobody really knows, but it was noted for producing gold. Another way that several commentators have interpreted men being scarcer than pure gold is by saying that men who take gold for a bribe are scarcer than the gold that is available to give for the bribes. Now, that is a stretch, but here's how this works. There aren't any Medes or not any Persians who will take a bribe in order to withhold their slaughter of the Babylonians. So verse 12 would read, I will make the Persians scarcer of smaller number than all the gold that is available to bribe them. There just aren't any Medians available for bribery. There aren't any Persians available for bribery. Well, although that's true, I think it's so difficult to really make the verse say that. You could say there are no Babylonians available to defend the kingdom, even if you pay them gold. They're scarcer than the gold that's there. More gold, not enough Babylonians to take the gold. They won't defend themselves. Well, we won't go there. Let's just say that the people in Babylon are scarce because they're wiped out. Verse 13, therefore, God says, I will make the heavens tremble. Now, again, if you want to take that literally, as John Gill says, some do take this literally at the taking of Babylon. You could say that the heavens tremble literally with dreadful thunders and lightnings. I don't have any problem with that. I think, though, that most probably it's talking about the shaking of the natural elements, just like the sun going dark and the moon not giving its light and the stars going dark. Now, I didn't mention this when I was talking about how the sun going dark could not be from fire coming up and smoke coming up from Babylon in 539 BC when it was destroyed by the Persians. Here's what Wikipedia says about the taking of Babylon by the Persians. Both the Babylonian Chronicles and the Cyrus Cylinder describe Babylon being taken without battle, whereas the Greek historians Herodotus and Xenophon report that the city was besieged. So there's a split of authority among the historical sources, but none of the historical sources say anything about the city being burnt up. We go now to Isaiah 13, verses 14 through 18. Isaiah continues, "Like a hunted gazelle, like sheep without a shepherd, each will return to his own people, each will flee to his native land. Whoever is captured will be thrust through. All who are caught will fall by the sword. Their infants will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be looted and their wives ravished. See, I will stir up against them the Medes who do not care for silver and have no delight in gold. Their bows will strike down the young men. They will have no mercy on infants, nor will they look with compassion on children." Now in verse 14, Isaiah says, "Each will return to his own people." Who is Isaiah referring to? As Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, that this verse refers to foreigners who were called in by the king of Babylon to assist Babylon, and now they're getting out of Dodge, heading back home. They see that Babylon is about to be taken, so they flee back to their own countries, and so they left the city of Babylon naked and defenseless. There are two scriptures in Jeremiah which tend to back up that interpretation. Jeremiah 50, verse 16, "Cut off the sower from Babylon as well as him who wields the sickle at harvest time. Because of the oppressor's sword, each will turn to his own people, each will flee to his own land." Jeremiah 51, verse 9, "We tried to heal Babylon, but she could not be healed. Abandon her. Let each of us go to his own land, for her judgment extends to the sky and reaches as far as the clouds." Now in verse 15, Isaiah turns to the people who are left in Babylon, the people who stay in Babylon and don't return to their native lands. "Whoever among these people are captured will be thrust through." Now this was done by the orders of Cyrus, according to the Greek historian Xenophon. Cyrus said that those who were found within the streets, outside of their houses in the streets, should be slain, and Cyrus says that there needed to be a proclamation in Babylon in the Syriac language that those who were within doors should continue there, but if they were found without, they should be put to death. In other words, stay inside or you're going to get stabbed to death. And those orders were executed. And so Isaiah's statement that whoever's captured will be thrust through was carried out in history and fulfilled perfectly. All who are caught will fall by the sword. Verse 16, their infants will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. There's another scripture that talks about that, Psalms 137, verses 8 through 9. "O daughter of Babylon," daughter means population of, "O daughter of Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is he who repays you for what you have done to us." The "he who repays you" is talking about Persia. They're happy because they have won the battle. "Happy is he who repays you for what you have done to us." He, the Persians, "who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks." This is typical of the bloodlust that happens in the fall of cities in ancient warfare. Now, Psalms 137, 8 through 9, depending on when it was written, and I assume it was written before the fall of Babylon, which would make the psalm prophetic rather than historical, but it's the same idea. "The Babylonians' houses will be looted and their wives ravished." Ravished means raped. Just like they had ravished the women in Zion in 586 BC when the Babylonians had taken over Jerusalem and done the same thing. They had smashed the infants against the rocks. They had raped the women. They had done all that. And so now, what goes around comes around. One of my commentators says that the women were raped before their husbands' eyes. Wouldn't surprise me. Verse 17, Isaiah continues, speaking God's words, "I, God, will stir up against them, against the Babylonians, the Medes." Now that means the Persians. Why does Isaiah call the Persians the Medes? Well, as Ellicott, the commentator, says, in naming the Medes and not the Persians as the conquerors of Babylon, Isaiah was probably influenced by the greater prominence of the former. Just as the Greeks spoke of them and used such terms as Medism when they came in contact with the Medo-Persian monarchy. And that's true. I've read enough Greek history to know that. They called it Mediasing, which means you took Persian money. But they didn't say Persianizing. They said Mediasing when the cities in Asia Minor would take Persian money. So Medes is the same thing as the Medo-Persians. They came in 539 B.C. They do not care for silver and have no delight in gold. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't like silver and gold. Obviously, everybody likes silver and gold, but it means they didn't like silver and gold bribes to stop them from carrying out the destruction of Babylon. This merely means that compared to killing Babylonians, plunder was second on their minds. It was impossible for the Babylonians to buy their lives with gold. We move now to Isaiah 13, verses 19 through 22. Isaiah continues, Babylon, the jewel of kingdoms, the glory of the Babylonians' pride, will be overthrown by God like Sodom and Gomorrah. She will never be inhabited or lived in through all generations. No Arab will pitch his tent there. No shepherd will rest his flocks there. But desert creatures will lie there. Jackals will fill her houses. There the owls will dwell. And there the wild goats will leap about. Hyenas will howl in her strongholds, jackals in her luxurious palaces. Her time is at hand, and her days will not be prolonged. Babylon in verse 19 is called by Isaiah the jewel of kingdoms. It was the first and most ancient kingdom, really. Genesis 10, verses 9 through 10 in the Table of Nations says this, He was a powerful hunter, referring to Nimrod, in the sight of the Lord. That is why it is said, like Nimrod, a powerful hunter in the sight of the Lord. His kingdom started with Babylon, so way back there in ancient times. Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh, the land of Shinar, that's in the Mesopotamian Valley near the Persian Gulf. All these other places are very famous. Akkad, of course, is the name for the Akkadian language. That ancient language was very well known among ancient Near Eastern historians. So Babylon's been around a long time. Now, of course, this Babylon that we are dealing with now that's about to go down is the Neo-Babylonian Empire, which was not begun until Battle of Carchemish, I guess, when they beat the Assyrians finally in 603 BC, if my memory is correct. But there was an ancient Babylonian Empire, which I'm sure the new Babylonian Empire was proud of, if indeed Isaiah is referring to that. Or maybe he's just talking about the Neo-Babylonian Empire. It was pretty prideful, too. It, too, was the jewel of kingdoms. It had spread all over the ancient Near East. Isaiah 47, verse 5, in a different chapter, calls Babylon the Lady of Kingdoms. Isaiah 47, 5, daughter Chaldea. Chaldea, of course, is another name for the Babylonians. Daughter Chaldea, sit in silence and go into darkness, for you will no longer be called Mistress of Kingdoms. The Lady of Kingdoms, the Mistress of Kingdoms. Babylon was famous, the city, was famous for pompous buildings, the number of inhabitants, its riches, its wealth. In Daniel 4:30, we see Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, saying this, Is this not Babylon the Great? Notice the great. Is this not Babylon the Great that I have built by my vast power to be a royal residence and to display my majestic glory? So Babylon was the jewel of kingdoms, but she's going to end up looking like Sodom and Gomorrah, which is pretty bad, as you know. What's the point of comparison? Well, let's look at what the point of comparison is not. Babylon and Sodom and Gomorrah were not destroyed by the same means. Babylon was not destroyed by fire from heaven, which I take to be volcanic eruptions like Sodom was. We can't make a comparison with the swiftness of destruction. Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed in one day. Babylon took many years to decline to a desert. Here's what Guzik, the commentator, quoting Wolfe, says about Babylon. The walls were left standing until 518 B.C., and general desolation did not set in until the 3rd century B.C. Babylon gradually fell into decay, and the prophecy of Isaiah was fulfilled. Babylon became completely depopulated by the time of the Muslim conquest in the 7th century A.D., and to this day it lies deserted, and in fact it's still deserted. It's an archaeological site now. So if Babylon was not destroyed by the same means as Sodom and Gomorrah, nor destroyed as swiftly as Sodom and Gomorrah, how was Babylon destroyed like Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, the swiftness of the defeat. The men of Babylon were feasting like the men of Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember Belshazzar's feast, the writing on the wall, and all that. And Babylon was taken down in one night, just like the people of Sodom and Gomorrah were taken down. It happened very quickly in one night. Kaboom, it's over. Also, Babylon was destroyed completely, just like Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed completely. Even today, there's nothing left of Babylon. There's nothing left of Sodom and Gomorrah. So to summarize, Babylon was not destroyed in the same way that Sodom and Gomorrah was, by fire. Babylon was not destroyed as swiftly as Sodom and Gomorrah was. It took many years for Babylon to go down, Sodom and Gomorrah in one day. But Babylon was defeated quickly, maybe not destroyed quickly, but Babylon was defeated quickly like Sodom and Gomorrah in one day. And Babylon was totally destroyed, just like Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, in verse 20, she will never be inhabited. Of course, Babylon never has been inhabited, as John Gill says, not until this day. Now, this is a bone of contention by skeptics who say that the Babylonian Empire has been inhabited till this day. Actually, it's inhabited now in Iraq. But notice here that Isaiah is speaking of the city of Babylon, not the land of Babylon. I have a big discussion of this, or I will have a big discussion of this in Jeremiah chapter 50 when we get there. I'll save the fuller discussion till then, but just for right now, let's point out that this is the city of Babylon that will never be inhabited again, not the empire, because obviously the empire was inhabited again. In verse 20, Isaiah says, no Arab will pitch his tent in the city of Babylon. Well, why would no Arab pitch his tent in the city of Babylon? Well, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that it's because Arabs were afraid of evil spirits living there. They believed that the ghost of Nimrod haunted the city, and therefore the Arabs would not spend the night there. Arabs, of course, are the people who live in the desert regions of Saudi Arabia, perhaps Bedouins. I think the easiest way to interpret that, though, is the reason that no Arab would pitch his tent there is because the city was destroyed. No place to pitch his tent. Now, again, skeptics will say, oh, yes, Arabs did pitch their tent there in the city of Babylon. Well, they might cite some occasional Arabs who park themselves there, but pitch means to live, not just wander through the city, but no Arab will live there again. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown goes even further and says that not even a temporary resting place was there. As I mentioned earlier, he said that evil spirits scared Arabs from even making a pit stop in the city of Babylon. But I think it's easier to say no. It means that no Arab will live there because the city's destroyed. And in verse 21, we've got a great poetic reference to the deserted city. Jackals in the houses, owls in the houses, wild goats jumping around, hyenas howling in the background, jackals living in the palaces. Now here's a translation issue in verse 22, hyenas and jackals. The KJV translates that as satyrs and dragons. Skeptics will take that translation and mock Isaiah. They say that satyrs and dragons are mythical, and Isaiah is predicting that mythical characters are going to rest in Babylon. Well, it's just translation. Hyenas and jackals, Home and Christian Study Bible, those animals are not mythical. So Isaiah's prophecy concerning Babylon was completely fulfilled. Let me requote Guzik again. Babylon became completely depopulated by the time of the Muslim conquest in the 7th century AD, and to this day it lies deserted. Ladies and gentlemen, on that triumphant note, we have now finished Isaiah chapter 13, and we are prepared now to go in our next audio to Isaiah chapter 14, which I will entitle The Restoration of Jacob. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope very much that you enjoyed this one.